It's great to be with you. And inevitably, we've sort of already begun to stray into some of the stuff that I want to pick up on. And when I was asked to speak on this issue of ethics on the battlefield, I thought, yeah, that's fine. When you actually sit down to prepare this stuff, you realize you could end up by being here for 3 days and write a book, basically. So my mission is to talk to you for about 40 minutes or so. Just looking at the clock, it's about 22. We're due to finish at 5:30, but again, if we stray slightly over, I'm sure that will be okay. On this issue of ethics on the battlefield, essentially I'm going to draw from the second half of Augustine's Just War Principles that Nigel's already touched on, ensuring justice in the conduct of a war or an operation. And then I'm going to obviously open things up for questions. So your mission is to listen and then to give me a hard time as you gave Nigel a hard time in questions. If you finish your mission before I finish mine, then the door's that way and the sun is shining. Take a drink with you and go and relax. H.G. Wells, Nigel's heard me say this before, but it's my favourite quote really. I usually say it when I stand up to speak. H.G. Wells is reputed to have said that the professional military mind is by necessity an inferior and unimaginative mind. No man, he said, of high intellectual ability would willingly imprison his gifts in such a calling. So that's me, in comparison to Nigel, of course. So what you're going to get from me is not not unintellectual, I don't think, but it's certainly based unashamedly on the baggage of my 40-odd years of military experience, the last 26 of them as a Christian. I joined the Army as a cadet in 1964, 20 years after D-Day, and eventually commissioned in 1971, when I was 20. And like most of my contemporaries, I served in Northern Ireland, in my case as a bomb disposal operator, amongst other things, and experienced that being the middle of a divided place, the middle of two sides of a long-standing conflict, experiencing the reality behind the headlines, the gangsters, the protection rackets, the greed, and the desire for power. Later on, I went to Germany 4 times, a divided Germany, of course, in those days with NATO, a divided Cyprus with the UN, the Balkans 3 times, the Middle East twice, in 91, the first Gulf campaign with 1st Armored Division, and then the one that was referred to when I worked in Washington, Kuwait, and then Baghdad. And in between all of that, on my 30th birthday, Easter Sunday, 1981, I became a Christian, which obviously defined the years ever since, in the Garden Tomb in Jerusalem. Now, throughout those years, I've experienced the religious, the ethnic, the cultural bigotry that divides our world, and the brutality that flows from it, and many of you have too. And we all know this bigotry is not one-sided. There are rarely such things as goodies and baddies in this business of the battlefield. But for me anyway, words like sin and evil are not interesting theological discussions, they're a stark reality of a brutal world. So being who I am and doing what I did for 40 years, you're probably not going to be too surprised at some of the things that I have to say, but I hope, building on what Nigel said, it will open us up for a debate to continue over lunch and so on. And it's this issue of ethics on the battlefield, I think, is really important. We've already sort of touched on that, but it's also important because it's alive, I think, across society as a whole. Ethics, or the lack of them, in the city, in parliament, in the media, has hit the headlines over the last few years, and we're not immune to that in the military. The difference, of course, is in our case, these are issues of life and death, literally, therefore we need to take them very seriously. I was chatting with General Nick Carter about 10 days ago. Nick is about to become the next chief of the General Staff, and I was talking to him about the implications of the fact that the British government has been referred to the International Criminal Court. Now, when we talk about the British government, we actually mean the MOD, and when we talk about the MOD, we actually mean soldiers on the battlefield have done things which are now being referred to an International Criminal Court that was set up to investigate the genocides and the things that Nigel referred to. And the implications of that, I think, you know, this is not good news that we should have been referred. The truth, probably, though, is that we shouldn't be too surprised. History tells us that no military is perfect. I was reading Anthony Beaver's book on D-Day again just a few weeks ago in the run-up to the D-Day celebrations, and I was once again forcibly struck by the brutality of the fighting. What each side got up to hardly bears scrutiny in today's debate on issues like ethics. What the Nazis did in World War II, of course, is easily condemned, but many Allied soldiers did serious mischief as well, even if the cause was a just one, which I think it was. Watching the recent D-Day commemorations reinforced my view that in a world of injustice, there are definitely some things worth fighting for, and if necessary, dying for. In a sinful world, though, as Nigel has already said, there's no such thing as a purely just war. But there is justified war. How we fight that war is what we're talking about now. Whether that battlefield is the killing fields of Normandy, countering terrorism in Londonderry or Belfast, dealing with insurgency in Basra or Helmand, or keeping and reinforcing the peace or enforcing the peace in places like the Balkans and Kosovo. Born of the late Robin Cook's so-called ethical dimension in foreign policy in 1997, you may remember the term force for good first appeared in the lexicon, defence lexicon, in the 1998 Strategic Defence Review. And it so caught the government's eye, and indeed many others' eye, and it came out of PUS at the time, I'm pretty confident in saying that, it caught my eye, I have to say, that it still is one of the headlines in terms of the defence vision. That in defending the United Kingdom and its interests and in strengthening international peace and stability, our armed forces should indeed be a force for good in the world and conduct our operations well. What is goodness? Well, we could have the next few hours debating that. But in simple terms, you remember in Luke's Gospel, the soldiers go to John and they say to John the Baptist, what must we do to be saved? And rather sadly, I always think he tells them to be content with his pay. Do you remember? But more importantly, he also tells them effectively not to abuse their power. As the Message translation puts it, no shakedowns, no blackmail, be content with your rations. Which is quite well phrased, I think. Goodness, in the context of what I'm talking about, perhaps, therefore, is not abusing our power. The accepted principles for the conduct of an operation are, as we've touched on already, proportionality and discrimination. Easily said, but not easy to exercise, particularly when the battlefield is no longer well-defined in space or belligerent or cause. War is the province of uncertainty. Operations are, by their very nature, physically and mentally demanding, extremely unpredictable, potentially, obviously dangerous, characterized by fear, by fatigue and discomfort. And the stark reality for the military today is that we operate within a mass of laws, conventions and protocols, and the accompanying collection of human rights, charters and rules of engagement, all subject to deep scrutiny, always by the broadcast and print journalists, usually by the human rights bodies, and of course increasingly by lawyers seeking compensation for their clients. The distinction between law, morality, ethics and military reality quickly blurs on a battlefield. Lieutenant General Sir Alistair Irwin, who was an interesting guy, I don't know if many of you know him, he's a great, great chap, and he's written a fair bit about this, and he says, well, he puts it this way, there are many prowling the touchline, waiting for every infringement of the rules. In their article in the spring 2000 edition of the British Army Review, Patrick Milam, who's also written quite a lot about this issue of ethics, and Lee Willett wrote, in this new age of universal human rights and ethics of conduct, the straightforward virtues of a previous age of massed armies, navies and air forces have been joined by a complex series of political, philosophical, legal and socio-psychological considerations. Armed forces in the forefront of international security now have to be ready to intervene in what Michael Ignatieff terms the zones of danger caused by failed states trying to rebuild or reacting to their inability to do so. But military personnel brought up in liberal democracies find moral difficulty in military interventions and in addressing such difficulties with appropriate legal, moral and practical action. And the whole debate, of course, lies within a paradox, which is, and we should never lose sight of this, the principal role of an army or a navy or an air force, the reason they exist is to deliver fighting power, not to be nice. There are no prizes for coming second on a battlefield. The test is war and battle, the result triumph or defeat. That said, split-second decisions and actions may nonetheless be seen retrospectively by courts, civil or military, domestic or international, or by public opinion as unjust or even criminal. And the end result is that while some, like the British government, do argue that military can indeed be a force for good in the world, the reality is that in the real world, events have a habit of interfering. I don't know whether you remember a Canadian parachute battalion had to be disbanded in disgrace when its soldiers lost self-control in Somalia in 1993. Whilst in the same operation, a unit of US Army Rangers was overwhelmed and butchered, with soldiers' bodies being dragged through the streets in full view of those watching CNN. In Rwanda in 1994, A small UN force under a Canadian general had effectively to stand by and watch as 800,000 were slaughtered. And Dutch troops were humiliated in Srebrenica in 1995 when their rules of engagement did not permit them to respond to Serb ethnic cleansing. So how exactly do we deal with people prepared to use any means to achieve their ends? Suicide bombings, ethnic massacres, indiscriminate terrorism, and the bloody combat that flows from it all. How do we establish justice and deal with sin and evil, deliver moral, ethical, legal accountability? Now, I for one don't think that you can simply legislate for morality. It's not an important part of this, but it is not the totality of it. The practical delivery of ethics on the battlefield, or indeed anywhere else, has, I believe, to be built on a solid foundation, not on shifting sands. Comments made by a US Marine Corps general called Hagi, who was then the head of the US Marines, on what he called marine virtue ring as true today as they did when he wrote them about a decade ago, about 11 years ago. He said this: "Recent serious allegations concerning actions of Marines in combat have caused me concern. They should cause you, the Marine Corps to whom this was addressed, to be concerned as well. To ensure we continue to live up to General Lejeune's description of a Marine as someone who demonstrates all that is highest in military efficiency and soldierly virtue, I would like to review the importance of our core values. As Marines," he said, "you were taught from your earliest days in the Corps about our core values of honour, courage and commitment. These values are part of and belong to all Marines, regardless of their role, gender or grade. They guide us in all we do," he said, "whether in combat, in garrison, on leave, or liberty. To a Marine, honour is more than just honesty. It means having uncompromising integrity and being accountable for all actions. To most Marines, the most difficult part of courage is not the raw physical courage that we see so often on today's battlefield. It is rather the moral courage to do the right thing in the face of danger," and I think interestingly he then adds, "and pressure from other Marines. Finally, commitment is the focus on caring for one another and upholding the great ideals of our corps and country." He talks about being strong to help one another to measure up. The war will test the commitment to their belief in the rule of law. He says, "We've all been educated in the law of armed conflict, and we continue to reinforce the training. We do not employ force," he says, "just for the sake of employing force. We use lethal force only when justified, proportional, and most importantly, lawful. We follow the laws and regulations, Geneva Conventions, rules of engagement. That," he says, "is the American way of war. We must regulate force and violence. We only damage property that must be damaged. We protect the non-combatants we find on the battlefield." And he finally goes on to say that even after 30 years, very American this bit actually, "I still stand with pride every time I hear the Marines hymn. The words of that hymn mean something special to me, especially keep your honour clean." I think those are good words. I think they're important words. And we, the British military, can look back over the last three centuries to feats of arms, from Marlborough's Wars to the Peninsular Wars, from Waterloo to Balaclava and Lucknow, from Mons, the Somme, and Third Ypres to Caen, Falaise, Kohima, all the way up to Goose Green and Sangin. A list of British military virtues drawn up in 96, when we produced, some of you may remember, what we call the Right to be Different paper. And that paper talked of personal integrity, accepting hazard, courageous, honourable, humane, being a whole person and not duplicitous, trustworthy, intelligently obedient, self-confident, self-disciplined, altruistic, competent, able to function in adverse conditions with judgment and high personal standards. Again, not bad. We can put together long lists of this sort of stuff. Not unimportant. But these and the US Marine Corps values are the stuff of military hyperbole and ideology. Take them away and you're left with pure militarism. But we're not talking here about perfection, a perfectly conducted war. Again, as Nigel notes in his book, In Defense of War, no human action or enterprise is pure or unblemished. What this does not mean is that no human action can ever be right, but it does mean that no war between human beings will ever be just in a pure sense. But, and for me this is a crucial point, war and actions may nonetheless be justified. But even if they're justified, They will always be waged, as Nigel said already, by one set of sinners against another. War always causes terrible evils and drags us into places where we would not want or expect to go. And these virtues are not absolutes. They are inevitably variables, abstract concepts, really, more often than not diminished between the intent and the delivery. They are variable within all military units according to the mood of the day, the presence of danger, stress, physical deprivation, cognitive confusion, the state of morale, the course of the battle. And they are variable within soldiers, within individual soldiers, their background when they enlisted, the training they've received, the experience they've gained at various stages in their career. In other words, there is no superabundance of every virtue within every soldier or formation or army. The trick for us is to ensure that these exist as much as possible, that we have fully integrated them into our military ethos, our culture, and that they don't disintegrate quickly when they come under pressure. So how do we do that? Now, I don't know how much to go into this, but many of you will understand that the way the British Army doctrine summarizes fighting power is in this three components: the physical, the conceptual, and the moral. The physical component is the means to fight, the stuff. Having the latest and best equipment, the weapons, the helicopters and so forth, is obviously pretty crucial, and being able to sustain them at peak capacity. How we recruit people into the team, how we act toward them and employ them, the messages we send them about their individual and collective importance, and the professional standards we expect of them. All of those and more play their part. And those people and their equipment are converted into capability through demanding training, hard individual and collective training. There's absolutely no substitute to being together, seeing and smelling the body language. So we spend time together developing skills, learning about each other's strengths and weaknesses, getting tired, cold, wet. We get under each other's skins, and we learn how to deal with uncertainty and what we call the frictions of war. The conceptual component is the thought process behind the ability to fight, the thinking that goes into how we operate on the battlefield, how we get the best out of that stuff, how we maneuver to defeat the enemy. Education's the key. An understanding of conflict, how we operate, enables us to adapt over time. Technology changes and the nature of the battlefield changes. We develop doctrine, which is public, but also a shared implicit doctrine. We encourage debate, broad education, extend horizons, improve decision making, going on battlefield tours, staff rides, and all of that stuff. Analyzing what decisions were made and why, and then what happened as a result. And amongst those decisions will be decisions on this issue of ethics. The realities of war. Developing intuitive skills so that we will hopefully ensure that everyone has a feel for operations, and that come of the day we react instinctively and intuitively to the chaos that surrounds us. And frankly, if things are too cozy, encourage us to create the chaos that will confuse the enemy. Physical and conceptual. The third component is the moral component, the will to fight, the ability to get soldiers to fight and, if necessary, to die. The determination to succeed against all the odds. What is it that gets young soldiers out on patrol in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, knowing there's a fair chance they're going to be injured or killed? How do we get them to fight fairly, not to abuse their power? And our answer to that lies in establishing three fundamental things: the motivation, effective leadership, but crucially, an underpinning of an ethical base and a moral cohesion. Fighting power is morally based because all contact and activity between people is always morally charged, sometimes only slightly, but often substantially, and certainly on a battlefield. But the moral component is, of course, very difficult, if not impossible, to define. It rests on words like trust, loyalty, duty, honor, integrity, those values that the US Marine Corps were talking about, and those values that we've built into the British military. Such words are the key differentiators of a good or great leader over the poor or ordinary leader, between the good army and the brutal. And from them flows the ability to get people to fight, whatever that fight looks like, to dig deep, to go the extra mile, carry the extra burden, to press on. But crucially, unlike mere numbers or doctrinal niceties, it must also provide the framework for a sense of justice and righteousness, a determination to adhere to the core of those values and codes of behaviour, to follow the Geneva Convention, to follow the laws of armed conflict. And then I think, crucially, to face up to the reality that, like any other organisation, we are made up of flawed human beings. And those flawed human beings will get it wrong. And when they do get it wrong, we have to be an army, an air force, a navy that acknowledges that and deals with it. That's what separates out the good army from the brutal, between an army that uses its power to be a force for good and a destructive one that abuses its power. So what might that look like in practice, and what differentiates us, hopefully, from the people we're fighting against often? Alistair Irwin's chapter about asymmetric warfare in a book on military power that was edited by Brian Holden Reed, I don't know those of you know, remember Brian Holden Reed at the Staff College, noted that for the terrorist, there are no rules, no uniforms, no front line, no inhibitions, no limitations, no territory to defend. So the minimalist, as Alistair talks to the terrorist and the insurgent, they can choose where and when to strike. They can appear and disappear by cloaking themselves in what he calls the darkness of the underworld. For those who oppose him, the difficulties are intense. These are not two boxers facing up to each other in a ring in the dark, but rather two boxers, one of whom is invisible. How can he be found if he can't be seen? How can he be attacked if he can't be found? Terrorists and insurgents also, of course, have no inhibitions about breaking the law, especially the laws, it seems to me anyway, of democratic liberal states. Nor indeed do many others, it has to be said, operating on battlefields around the world. Nigel and I were chatting earlier, and I sometimes wonder whether this debate is a very Anglo-Saxon debate, because you don't hear much about it in other places. Many commentators also don't seem to be too repelled by that. They often present both boxers as equally flawed opponents. The minimalist can advance their cause by spinning a web of deceit and lies that may or may not be believed, but if discovered to be untrue, nobody thinks too much of it. Those defending democracy and the rule of law can't do that. We are expected to tell the truth. And alongside this so-called community justice by the insurgent, shooting people through the kneecap, through the buttocks, through the elbows, savage beatings, murders, are presented on the same basis as those attempting to uphold the rule of law. There is, of course, revulsion at the outcome of specific acts that lead to death and injury, but the constant offence against accepted moral codes with no principled obstacle to their freedom of action doesn't seem to undermine the cause of the terrorist or the insurgent. Now, it has to be said, of course, that police states and dictatorships will equally trample over human right and the law and the rule of law. But liberal democracies must behave differently. We cannot defeat terrorists and insurgents by joining them in the darkness of the underworld, by copying their methods. They can only be defeated by winning the battle of ideas, establishing truth, common humanity, ethics, and so on, even if, as some claim, that means we must operate with one hand tied behind our back. So, for example, brutality, in whatever guise, including the mistreatment of prisoners and torture, will always come back to bite us. And that often, interestingly, if not always, applies to the individuals who commit that brutality, as well as the democratic cause they're supposed to be defending. The anguish experienced by many French officers and men who came to regret their part in torturing Algerian suspects, particularly in the Battle of Algiers, is an oft-quoted example, but no less powerful for that. Some, including a journalist called Edward Baer, would you believe, argued that the FLN terrorist network would never have been overcome by General Massoud without the use of torture. But in my view, rightly, others have countered this by saying that torture may have saved some lives by discovering the whereabouts of, say, an IED, but it was at the expense of honour and at the same time only resulted in the recruitment of 50 new terrorists who, operating in another way and in another place, caused many more deaths. As Albert Camus says, it is better to suffer certain injustices than to commit them. Interestingly, an official who'd been a prisoner of the Germans at Dachau and who had been tortured there refused to have a captured terrorist tortured in Algeria, even though the terrorist had been caught red-handed laying one of two bombs that he was known to have made, and even though the whereabouts of the second bomb was unknown. Obviously, people wanted to torture him in order to find out where that second bomb was. He tells the story thus: I trembled the whole afternoon. But if you once get into the torture business, you're lost. Understand this: fear was the basis of it all. And then he adds, and I think this is really helpful, all of our so-called civilization is covered with a varnish. Scratch it, and underneath you find fear. The French, he said, even the Germans are not torturers by nature, but when you see the throats of your comrades slit, then the varnish disappears. The reality is that we, as the democracies, have to preserve the coat of varnish in a good state of repair, because operating outside the law and the moral code, outside of an ethical framework, always scratches the varnish. It may solve short-term tactical or even operational level problems, but engaging in excessive violence and other forms of illegality is always counterproductive, merely serving to encourage greater resistance. The German army brutally swept through Eastern Europe in 1941, alienating countries that actually welcomed the removal of communism. The resulting resistance led to even more brutal retaliation, and that in turn led to more partisan and guerrilla attacks. Such action and reaction has been repeated throughout history in numerous places, and sadly, although the British Army has an impressive record of success on operations, some of our methods in the past were pretty heavy-handed and would certainly not survive contact with modern lawyers or the media. In May 1947, an Israeli in Palestine, you remember we had the mandate to look after Palestine at that stage, a guy called Alexander Rubovitz disappeared and was believed to have been murdered by a small group of men led by a decorated SAS officer called Ray Farron. How SAS operations were conducted in World War II, and then subsequently in Palestine, Malaya, Cyprus, Oman, all the way through to the Falklands, Northern Islands, Iraq and Afghanistan and so on, I think would make a pretty interesting case study. And I know we've chatted about it once or twice too. But in 1947, Farron apparently believed he had been given a free hand to act, and he did so brutally. Actually, to be fair, he hadn't been given a free hand, and he was tried by court-martial for the murder. And the very fact that he was put on trial tells its own story. Rather like the recent trial of the Royal Marine sergeant who shot and killed an Afghan insurgent in a field in Helmand, do you remember? And he was found guilty of murder. But, maybe as a sign of the times in 1947, Farron was acquitted, and it resulted in a chain of retaliation and reprisal. Two British NCOs were kidnapped and later hanged, and their bodies were strung up on a eucalyptus tree and booby-trapped, and the result was that the officer who cut them down was severely injured. Violent reprisals by troops and police in Tel Aviv culminated in the machine gunning of Jewish shops and cafes by police armoured cars, and five people were killed. All this merely served to strengthen support by the infamous Stern Gang, the leaders of a popular but brutal resistance. Sadly, there are many other stories too. In Ireland in 1921, we imposed martial law, which led, would you believe, to the destruction of any house from which shots were fired against the security forces, or from where the preparation of an IRA ambush could supposedly have been seen, and therefore the inhabitants of that house should have reported it to the authorities. And in the 1970s, some of you remember, we introduced internment without trial, a great mistake in my view. In the first Gulf War, when I served there, we were stood in danger of lacking the capacity to cope with large numbers of Iraqi prisoners. And in 2003, of course, the treatment of prisoners became a public scandal and led to strategic failure. Many in Afghanistan believe we used far too much air-delivered and artillery kinetic attack after we went into Helmand in 2006 because of our limited force levels, very small force. A senior Royal Naval officer rang me up out of the blue and asked to come and see me after he'd done a tour in Afghanistan, making this exact point. As far as he was concerned, we were not doing the right thing. And as a result of that, I had a conversation with the then CGS. And my youngest son, Stephen, who worked in the intelligence world, was visibly shaken by what he experienced in that world when he served in Afghanistan last year. When we get it wrong, when there are lapses in behavior and conduct, they must be confronted. Whenever a law is broken, as it is bound to be from time to time, either by mistake or willfully, those who are concerned with that have to be dealt with. Events such as those perpetrated in Abu Ghraib or during the detention of Baba Musa by our own forces are not only tragic, but inexcusable and do our cause no good at all. The conduct of those people, however few, who took it upon themselves to deliberately abuse Iraqi civilians should not be tolerated. Immediate remedial action should have been scrupulously and swiftly applied, but again, easy to say, difficult to apply in practice, for all sorts of reasons. It means admitting the action, investigating and punishing the offenders, apologizing, maybe even paying compensation. History judges harshly when officers or soldiers act in a way contrary to our stated values and standards and fail to respect the human rights of those they have gone, in theory anyway, to help. Being open and honest, even humble from the outset, may be painful, but it pays huge dividends. For once the moral high ground has been lost, once the varnish has been scratched and we have tumbled into the dark valley alongside the insurgent, then we're in trouble. And an army that wants to be remembered as a force for good needs to remember that. Alistair Owen also tells of asking an eminent QC specialising in human rights, how is it possible for a democracy to defend itself without occasionally or usually resorting to torture, summary arrest, and detention without trial, and so on? The QC's response was to ask another series of questions. Are the papers being delivered? Can the children go to school? Can you safely get to a hospital? Do the trains run? If so, then there is absolutely no reason for the varnish to slip. Only when the whole structure of a society is collapsing and anarchy is imminent should democracies allow themselves to take these desperate measures. And then he adds, and those measures must be enacted only through democratic legislation. It's not up to the soldiers on the battlefield to decide that they're going to change the laws, change the rules. So where does all that take us? When the chips are down, what encourages us, drives us to do what is right out on the battlefield? I appeared as a witness in The Hague in the international court trials for the former Yugoslavia some years ago. And on the one hand, my experiences there as I listened and engaged with people convinced me that for all of our failings, frankly, we stand head and shoulders above most, the vast majority of other armies and air forces and navies on this issue. But somewhat ironically, I subsequently heard from Charles only the other day, for the first time, that the ICRC, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Charles, what I heard, the ICRC believed that the former Yugoslavia had in place the best law of armed conflict training that they had seen anywhere. So this is clearly more than just about training. We spend months on the ranges, zeroing our weapons and ensuring we can shoot straight. We spend months in the gym and tabbing and running to ensure that we're physically fit. That is training. But on the other hand, I referred to earlier, we spend years educating our leaders in staff colleges and elsewhere on operational concepts and doctrine, and we need to take the education of ethics equally seriously. War is a human activity, a context of wills, and people are ultimately the top and bottom of the whole debate. The competing pressures of today's society, where individualism dominates and the utility of armed force is openly debated, and the increasingly complex operating environment, make the intellectual and moral preparation of our soldiers as important, if not more important, than any military training. So the challenge for our military leaders is therefore to educate our young officers and soldiers, each one of them, of course, potentially an individual decision maker on the battlefield, so that all concerned understand the rationale and the underpinning roots behind the British Army, for example, core values. The sea drills, as I think they're still called. Selfless commitment, courage, discipline, integrity, loyalty, respect for others. And learn how to apply those values in their conduct on the battlefield, day by day, tour by tour. And like any ethical creed, they must be learned and followed for their own good, not simply as a means to an end. Soldiers at all levels must be properly prepared for the ethical challenge they will face in conflict. And it's too late to think about this education as we go up the steps of an aeroplane to fly into a theatre of operations, which frankly has been my experience over the years. In all of the various places that I worked over those years, there was a churning mix of military, media, politicians, diplomats, civil servants, a whole mass of non-governmental aid agencies and international organisations like the UN, and increasingly over the last decade a web of private sector players. They were fascinating people to deal with and to work with, and almost invariably, they were pretty well trained. But perhaps my most important observation from all of that time was the general shortage of character. Too often, lofty thoughts and ideals disappeared as fast as the morning mist on a sunny day when the pressure mounted. And we need to be different in the military. Belonging to something special, doing the right thing and making a positive difference means being embedded deep within an enduring ethos and culture. And that culture ultimately rests on character. Lord Moran, Churchill's doctor, commented that a man of character in peace is a man of courage in war. And character like morality can't be taught or legislated for or bought. It has to be a habit. Aristotle taught it as a habit, the daily choice of right instead of wrong. It's a moral quality that grows to maturity in peace and is not suddenly developed at the outbreak of war. Character defines the person, determines behaviour. It's who we are and what we get up to in the dark when we don't think anybody's watching. And most of the things that go wrong on a battlefield are when people think that nobody's watching. It's a famous story of a German soldier who was killing Jews in Eastern Europe. And one of them said to him, "God is watching you." And he said, "I don't believe in God, and nobody is watching me." As he then machine gunned all these Jewish prisoners and killed them all. So character, I think, underpins the ethics on the battlefield for us in the British military. For some, belief in the cause, belief in the leader, even given the tribal nature of the British Army, belief in the regiment will be enough. Putting yourself, others rather, before oneself is a proven means of keeping the moral compass steady, and our unique regimental system has shown time and time again that our soldiers usually do the right thing out of a desire not to let down their mates or their regiment. But character, I think, is deeper than that. And if we can't rely on just that system. So I'm want to open up for questions. I've tried not to talk about my own particular experiences on particular battlefields, although I can talk about that in the context of Macedonia, Kosovo and elsewhere. My point that I want to end with is this is a really important issue. How we conduct ourselves on a battlefield matters. And for those reasons and more, we have to see these issues as personal and urgent. They're not easy, and we need to understand that. And I'm conscious that I haven't talked about the ethics of UAVs or cyber, all these other things that are beginning to hit the headlines, and we might want to tease that out a bit. But I do think that these values are very important, and they're a challenge to live up to. Ultimately, of course, and you would expect me to say this in this context, we need to build all of this on a rock, not on shifting sands. And for me, that rock is a spiritual rock, and we might want to touch on that as we open things up.
To what extent is that a problem for us?
Well, I think it is a problem. I think one needs to be careful about, you know, in a way being sweepingly judgmental, that anybody who doesn't acknowledge that Judeo-Christian heritage cannot be ethical on the battlefield in the context of this conversation. But I think, you know, it does worry me. When I joined in 69 to go to Sandhurst, there was a general, just assumption really, that everybody came from that perspective. And most British Army officers and so forth had been educated in a way that gave them that underpinning ethic. Wavell, I did bring this, I was going to read that earlier, but Wavell said in Unorthodox Soldiering, "I have sometimes traced a parallel between the various sects of the Christian religion and those of the armed forces." You may have heard this before. "In my parallel, the Catholic Church corresponds to the Brigade of Guards, with perfect discipline, much ceremony, and strict adherence to the book in creed and drill. National churches, such as the Church of England, represent regular regiments of the line, with less discipline, less ceremonial, less absolutism, like the Guards. Then there are the territorials, the Methodists, the Baptists, and the like, considered as mere amateurs, perhaps, by the Guards and the line, but stout and earnest fighters for the cause. Finally comes the irregulars, who may own no church and subscribe to no orthodox religion, but whose sniping ambushes against evil in the dark places of life may sometimes be more effective than all the church-going of the regulars." Now, Wavell writing at that time, 99% of the people would have understood what he was talking about and had a feel for that. The reality is, in today's world, that is not true. And the reason we had to write that right-to-be-different paper, and I remember when I was part of 3DIV, we were writing a whole series of things about, well, the values and standards. You know, we didn't have a booklet on values and standards. When I was at Sandhurst, people talked about officer qualities. We didn't have a booklet on officer qualities. Steve Deacon, who's still at Sandhurst, has written a number of papers on ethics at Sandhurst, the officer qualities and stuff. None of that was necessary 30, 40 years ago. And it is necessary now, but what worries me, and I sort of alluded to this, is that it's not about simply writing a pamphlet. It's about how do you inculcate that into people. Not to say that you have to be a Christian and get down on your knees every week and go to church, but that you have to embody and live this in a way where it is rooted in your psyche. It becomes part of who we are as an army. And I think it's particularly worrying amongst our officer corps, if I'm honest. I put on the table back there, some of you may have seen already, the last edition of the British Army Review. A colonel of the British Army wrote an article on why the British Army should become secular. And I was asked to write a counter-article, which I did, and they've both been published. People can have a look at it. I need to take it back with me, actually, if I may. But the interesting thing about that is trying to think through, and say, what are the potential consequences of an army that becomes secular? And I don't think we need to look far to see the consequences. We've had a lot of secular atheist regimes, humanist. We've had Pol Pot's Cambodia, Stalin's Russia, Hitler's Germany, Mao's China. These are not pleasant places to live. And their armies, and this is, I think, the important point, their armies are often very, very effective and very, very efficient. But they are brutal. They are not a force for good in the context of this debate. So my worry is that we are becoming, we're being pressured to become more secular in the armed forces. And the consequences of that won't be felt tomorrow morning, but they will be felt in a generation or two's time when all of this debate has been lost. And it's actually, I don't want to be unfair on him because it was actually quite a well-crafted article by Colonel Quinn. But at one point he talks about maybe we should adopt the Girl Guide's promise. Well, I have to tell you that I'm not too impressed with the idea of a British army modelling itself on the Girl Guide. You know, be true to yourself, whatever that means. So, you know, so it is a very important issue, this. And there's no doubt that there's been a change. Now, we have to engage with this graciously, and we have to engage with it intellectually and argue it from a solid platform. It's no good just preaching at people. It has to be based around fighting power. It has to be based around the overall intent of what the British Armed Forces are about. It has to be based around the sort of things I've tried to lay out there, which is when you get this wrong, it has serious implications on your operation, not just at the tactical and operational level, but often leads to strategic failure. And the prisoner scandals in Iraq and so forth, you know, I think one could argue were part of that strategic failure. Yeah, sorry, lots of hands going up. I know, and then I'll come to you.
General, linked to that then, could you comment perhaps on the role of chaplaincy in terms of ethics in the military on the battlefield?
My first comment is that ethics on the battlefield has got, I was going to say, has got nothing to do with that. I don't want to overplay it. This is a chain of command issue. This is about the commanding officer, the brigade commander, the divisional commander, the chief of the general staff, and I'm going to be sending a copy of this stuff to Nick. This is about them understanding that this issue of ethics is about operational capability. And what worries me, and has worried me for a long time, when it comes to mats and all of the, you know, the individual training stuff, when it comes to the sort of moral piece, a lot of COs just chuck it at the padre. And I think most padres should chuck it straight back, frankly, and they're not prepared to do that because they recognize that, you know, maybe they're part of the chain of command and, you know, they want to engage in this stuff. The padre is there to meet the spiritual needs of his soldiers or her soldiers. And that is crucially important, clearly. And we all know, you know, more double VC winners, padres and medics than anybody else. These are brave people and all that stuff. But that's what they're there for. They're not there to be responsible for the conduct of soldiers in places like Iraq or Palestine or wherever. So I'm not saying they don't have a role, and they do have a role in maybe, if nothing else, in just whispering gently in the commanding officer's ear, you do understand what this is about, and what are you going to do about it, come on, in a CO? And my concern is that nowhere near enough padres do that. I mean, Mark and I have been involved in, you know, dealing with chaplaincies and all, and as many in this room have been too. And it's quite a hard struggle, actually. So I think my answer is we need to separate these two things out. Chaplains have a crucial role in my view. They should be unashamedly there to meet the spiritual needs of their people. They should be engaging in that debate. They should be opening up that debate. And even the bravest soldiers, I mean, we all know this from our experience, you know, reach out for something beyond the normality. The old maxim that there are no atheists in the foxhole is clearly not true. But there aren't that many, actually. And a lot of the soldiers who've been through difficult times want to be able to sit down with the padre and chat and allow, you know, pray. And, you know, they may not understand all the deep theological stuff, but they want that. That's not the role of the commanding officer. But when it comes to how do we run the law of armed conflict, what is the Geneva Convention, how do we apply it, what does that look like on an operation? So which is why the CO of the Irish regiment, I've forgotten which one it was, but his speech before we went into Iraq, wasn't just, again, I meant what I said about the US Marine. These are good words, they're important words, and more COs should be using those sorts of words. Because you can, you know, that's what the chain of command is about, inspiring people to live better, to be better, to make a positive difference. So there's a crucial role for the padres, but it's not in that first piece, if that makes any sense. Thank you. You know, the Americans are different. I remember going to the States, I mean, there are a number of times, but I'd gone to a dinner night with a cavalry regiment, and about a week later I'd heard that the CO had been sacked because after the dinner had finished, one of his officers behaved badly with a woman officer. She had complained, and the CO was unilaterally sacked. You know, those words actually are very meaningful words to many in the American military. And I don't know whether you know, but Shinseki, who had stood out against Rumsfeld over the numbers for post-war Iraq and had been sacked, He resigned recently over some problems with the veterans, military veterans in America, which frankly, you know, had nothing to do with him in inverted commas. But he stood up and said, I was the head of this organization. This is not right. I will resign. So they take it very seriously, and I think we should applaud them for that. The Americans are often held up by people as being, well, you know, they often get a lot of flack. My experience of the American senior military is that they are pretty good. You don't get to the top of the American military system unless you're pretty good. And I mean that professionally and ethically. And they are still very dominantly a Christian organization. You know, a lot of their people are very committed Christians. In the UK, we've never actually, you know, if you look back through history, there haven't been many times when people have resigned over these sort of issues. We did sack a hell of a lot of generals in World War II. It's been like 160 generals were sacked in World War II, pretty summarily, when they did bad things on the battlefield, but they weren't sacked for ethical reasons. The interesting thing about Richard Dallet, my son-in-law, who was my ADC when I commanded a division and subsequently married my daughter, I told him it wasn't in the job description to marry my daughter. But his name's Richard, and he said to me on more than one occasion, the most respected senior officer in the British Army over the last couple of decades was Richard Sandy. was Richard Dallet. Not because they thought he was, you know, brilliant strategic thinker or anything like that, but because he stood and said what he felt needed to be said. And one of the things that worries me over here is that too many of our senior officers have retreated from this debate because they don't know how to deal with the political correctness. They're worried about offending people. They're worried about men and women of other faith in the military and so on. So they're not prepared. And Richard Dallet took the view, and I know Richard well, took the view that people need to understand who I am. What is at the core of who I am? At the core of me is my faith, my commitment to Christ. And from that flows all sorts of things. Is it perfect? Of course it's not. You know, do we make mistakes? Of course we do. But that's the core of who I am. And therefore, that gave me, I'm speaking for him now, but that gave me the courage to speak out against what I saw was happening that was wrong. Not many of our senior officers are prepared to do that. Now, to be fair, in private, I know that some, you know, have entered the debate with government, things like snatch Land Rovers and all that sort of stuff. And I know people like Mike Jackson very well, Rupert Smith and others. You know, these are good people, but, you know, in the context of this conversation, they're not the equivalent of what you're saying. Do I regret that? Yes. What do we do about it? I don't know. Part of me says you only have to read the Old Testament to realize these things are a bit of a sinusoidal, you know, but what worries me is what mess do we need to get into before certain senior people begin to say, actually, we've got to take this seriously. I'm rather hopeful that Nick Carter will, actually, because coming out of Afghanistan will give us an opportunity of standing back and taking stock of what has happened over the last 15, 20 years. Putting it into perspective, we all know that hundreds of thousands of soldiers have served in Iraq and Afghanistan over the years, and it's a relatively few who've been doing bad things. But this whole ethical piece is an important part, and we need to take it more seriously. So I'm hoping that he will stand up and talk about it. I mean, I appreciate it's not a question, but it's a very important part. It takes us back to Mark's opening question. When I went to Welbeck in 67, we had a fantastic chapel, and we were in it every week. When I went to Sandhurst, we were in the Sandhurst chapel basically every week. Sandhurst went through a period of time where they wanted to take the collect out and not mention Christ at all. And I was asked to go and speak on Christian leadership and so forth, which I did here, of course, you remember. And the reality was I wasn't invited back. I mean, I was asked specifically to speak on what I spoke on, and I think, you know, a lot of people just didn't like what I was saying. So it is a real issue. We have to win it, though, I think, on the basis of the justness, the ethics, and all the rest of it. We have to argue it graciously. We have to acknowledge that, I mean, I've worked for some very capable and very good people who would not consider themselves to be Christian. So, you know, it's how one balances that. We're saying, unless you have your faith firmly rooted on the rock of Christ, you can't be an ethical leader. I know. I do. I do see it more difficult. And again, in that article, secularism is often presented as a neutral position, and therefore everybody takes up their own place. It's not a neutral position. Secularism carries consequences. And I think we are undoubtedly, and this is why we need to be on the battlefield in this debate. I'm chatting to somebody the other day who was asking me, you know, what I was doing. And my answer was, I'm on a battlefield engaged in this whole debate in a number of different ways, actually, not just in the military. But I think we do all need to be on this battlefield. We do need to front up to the guys who are arguing this counter case and lead them to the logic of where they're taking us. And it is much more difficult in that secular environment, I think, to do that. And it is interesting how that's changed for the army. I mean, the right to be different paper was never voiced in the sense that, you know, we might have wanted to coin it. But it was voiced in a way of saying we are different because of what we do and what we are faced with and the whole business about fighting power and all the rest of it. I mean, that whole fighting power doctrine came out of that debate, Tim Granville Chapman. And even Tim was very reluctant, actually. I mean, Tim Granville Chapman, as you probably know, was a bit of an intellectual snob. I mean, he was a really capable bloke, but four star, I don't know, gunner, anyway. But he was, when I chatted to him about this, he was very reluctant to coin it in anything to do with a Judeo-Christian ethic. One of my favourite analogies is what's called the cut flower society. And I think this is quite a powerful analogy. My wife does most of the gardening at home, but, you know, we cut flowers, we put them in a vase on the dining room table or on the mantelpiece in the drawing room. And they look fine. But when you take cut flowers out of the foundation that they grew from and stick them in a vase, the reality is they will die. And they will not throw fresh seed into the soil from which they were taken. So this is not an immediate thing. The flowers look fine for a week or two. But I know they're going to end up in the brown bin or the blue bin or whichever bin it is in a couple of weeks' time. And my discussion with people is, you know, you want to take all this out of the root, the foundation where this was all grounded in over centuries, the Judeo-Christian ethic, and you want to put it in a vase, and you think it looks fine, and it does look fine for a while, but the generation is slowly, you know, easing its way out. The next generation and the generation after that come in, and they are not rooted in the same things. So, you know, the point is, as I try to explain, we've never been perfect. There's no great nirvana, wonderful age where everybody in the British Army was, you know, dutifully Christian and did wonderful things. That's not the truth. The reality is what I've tried to draw out. But it is nonetheless grounded in a debate that recognised that we needed to do things better, we needed to do things differently. And my concern is that under a secular system, particularly an atheistic system, that doesn't happen. I mean, the German army and the Soviet army were, as I said earlier, they were very effective, but they were brutal. And I don't think we want to be associated with that sort of brutality. And I don't think many in the British military want us to be there either, actually. So I think it is much more difficult, but that's more of a reason that we should engage in these things, why the AFCU's debate is so important, why we individually need to engage in this debate, not expect other people to be doing it for us. And that's why Nigel's book, actually, there's another book by Alan wrote the book, The Dove, The Fig Leaf and the Sword, which I've just reviewed actually with your book. Alan does Radio 4 Thought for the Day occasionally, but he's laid out the Christian view of just war and pacifism and so forth. And engaging intellectually in the academic world, engaging in our staff colleges and with our senior military and so forth, we all have to do that. And legality is not the totality of this answer. So you can't legislate for this stuff. It's not unimportant to have the laws and the conventions. I mean, they are very important. But in and of themselves, they're not sufficient, I don't think. No, thank you. And you're right, Patton is an interesting character. I mean, he thinks he's reincarnated from being a Roman, you know, a Roman leader. And he was devastated after he was taken away from command and stuck in the southeast of England and commanded the Phantom Corps that was going to invade across the Pas-de-Calais and all that. There's lots of stuff about Patton. When he was taken to a field hospital, he left and said to his staff, "Never take me one of those places again. I must not see the consequences. We have to win this." Now, I think Nigel would, I don't know, I'd be interested in Nigel's comment, but there is something about, we are going to win this. It's the balance between winning effectively, efficiently, and we are about delivering fighting power. There are no prizes for coming second on this battlefield. We have to win it. And the balance between that and moving across to the brutality and so on. I'm not aware that Patton had no qualms at all about saying, you know, don't worry, this is about us killing more Germans than they kill us. That's how we're going to win this. And instilling that into his military, I think, was pretty important, actually. So it's not about causing casualties on the battlefield in a pure sense. It's about the engagement with that, what you do afterwards, how you look after the prisoners, and all that other stuff that is drawn out of this. And there is a danger, and I sort of alluded to it before, we have to be very careful that we pretend that, you know, just because somebody's a Christian means they've got this cracked, or somebody who isn't a Christian can't possibly have this cracked. I mean, the spiritual business is, I think it was Voltaire who said, truth is like a sphere. You know, you can't see the totality of it from one direction. So we have to be humble about this debate. We'll happen to believe truth is personified in Christ. But, you know, so we don't have all the answers to this. Patton was what he was, but I have no problem with the fact that Patton wanted to win this campaign and was pretty ruthless about how he did it in the context of driving his people hard. I mean, the breakout down the the north, beyond, you know, up on the peninsula, Brittany, and then the breakdown to the south, and then the rush to Paris and so forth. Now, we can have a debate about the military of this. Montgomery would argue that the reason he did that was because Montgomery pinned down and held all of the German armour and all the rest of it, which enabled Patton to be released. But Monty was a pretty arrogant bloke, mind. And also Monty said, you know, I don't believe any man can command an army or an individual unless it's a sense of spiritual truth. You know, that generation of people would have found this conversation about atheism and secularism quite difficult to understand. They may not have all gone to, you know, passionately believed in the doctrine of deep theology and all the rest of it, but instinctively they would understand that there was a spiritual dimension to all of this, and they were not afraid of that. It's not an answer really. I mean, your point is well made, and I don't know whether Nigel wants to make a comment on it or not. But and by winning fast, and you know, not easy, but fast, overall, maybe less people are hurt. I mean, that's always, a dilemma. Mark, I know you want to finish, but just out of interest, because I've also put on that table, Charles and I were involved in the House of Commons Defence Committee looking at what's called lawfare, where the law of armed conflict and lawyers and so forth are affecting the conduct of war. It was a different guy to the naval man I referred to, but somebody else said to me, and I think it was one of the witnesses too in the inquiry, said, if you're in Iraq today and you've got, you know, a platoon around you, 20 blokes, and you're told that over the fields, half a mile away in a building, is an Afghan terrorist, and we need to deal with him. And you're sitting there thinking, right, do I take my platoon across this open field? Chance of getting blown up by an IED are pretty high. Chance of getting hit by machine gun fire is pretty high. Capture this terrorist, hopefully. Bring him back. Probably, because of the system of rights and all the rest of it, he'll be back on the street again in 3 days. Or do I simply call up for an air force to drop a 1,000-pound JDAM on that building? And a lot of people in Afghanistan have gone down the latter route, not the former route. Now, where's that in terms of ethics? Ironically, human rights law is probably killing more people than it thought it would, but I don't know, John.